From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So we replaced, I was just thinking about this, replaced by Rihanna in January. We're on GBH in February. It's really not the best. What did Ben Affleck, did you hear Ben Affleck last night?
I heard Ben Affleck last night.
15 years between appearances on the stage. So we're actually doing pretty well.
Yeah, well, here's the difference, Jim. You used to lie about having seen some of the Academy Award winners once again. You've seen none of them, I told
no,
you.
No, actually,
lying was not
true.
Allowed. I know which one you saw.
I saw Argo over the weekend that it was not a complete schneid.
Okay. Tell people what movie you really, like best, Jim.
Ted. I'm sorry. I mean, it is. What it is. Yeah, I don't want to start, by the way, I don't want to start too sappy, but it is our first show here, and we want to thank a lot of listeners, most of whom were rooting for us in the last month and a half, some weren't, some were in the middle. Our first email, by the way, we got our first email, BPR, Boston Public Radio, BPR at WGBH.org. It's from Stephen, our friend who's a lawyer, who basically bills his clients while he is listening to us.
That's correct.
It's a beautiful thing. Here it is, verbatim. Listen, it's quite beautiful, actually. We rarely read complimentary things, but I just do. It's our first show. On behalf of all of your loyal fans, we can't tell you how thrilled we are to have you back on the radio. So much so, Stephen writes, that we don't even mind that Jim is back as well. So it is
Thank you,
what
Stephen,
it is.
For that show of support. I love that.
Hey, one serious note before we start. A good friend of ours and this legendary, sweet, one of the most talented humans alive. You wrote a story that was teased on the front page of the Herald today about the great Chet Curtis. If people haven't picked up the Herald yet, just give a couple of seconds.
Well, here's the short story. Chet Curtis, right around Thanksgiving, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which is a very, very serious kind of cancer. But the good news is that there have been terrific breakthroughs just in recent months. I talked to his Dr. Mayer from Dana-Farber. Chet's really doing well. He's really responding. It's a breakthrough for him
and for pancreatic
cancer patients. And he's looking forward to his daughter's wedding in June. And I couldn't be happier for
him. You know what's one of the good notes, by the way, since we're starting on a positive note?
Yes, Jim.
It took till 3:30 this morning, 3:32 to be exact, until some middle-aged guy, I'm sure wearing a Tom Brady jersey, living in his mother's basement, posted a comment on your story, trashing both you and Chet. That's one of the things I love about the Herald, by the way. It's a beautiful thing. In any case, we're really thrilled to be here. On our first show, Marjorie and I decided we wanted to focus on the five men who want to succeed John Kerry. The Republicans are who, Marjorie, please?
The Republicans are Gabriel Gomez. He's the former Navy SEAL. State Representative Dan Winslow. And, of course, the former United States Attorney Michael Sullivan.
And on the Democratic side, Congressman Ed Markey and Steve Lynch. Our goal was to get every one of the five who were sitting down for interviews to join us today. And I guess we did. Good morning, Stephen Lynch. How are you, Congressman?
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie. Good to be with you.
By the way, don't screw this up. It's our first interview, so please.
That's right. Our whole career depends on you, Congressman Lynch.
It's great to be with you on GBH. This is terrific.
I know.
Thank you. We're thrilled.
Yeah, but I think you're going to probably have to clean up your act on this station.
Well, so might you, Steve Lynch. So we'll see what happens.
Now, are you guys going to ask me for money?
No. Well, speaking of cleaning up acts, I thought of you over the weekend because Argo, of course, won Best Picture. It was about the Iranian hostage crisis back in 1979.
Yeah.
You got in some hot water. I mean, some people liked you for it, Steve, but you were kind of a young man.
I was an iron worker at the
time. What happened?
Well, we were on a lunch break, and I was going to meet someone for lunch, and I happened to go by the McCormick Building near City Hall Plaza, and there was a large group of Iranian students chanting, basically, U.S. out of Iran. And at the time, ironically, Iran was holding the hostages.
Yes.
And we, every night, day 163.
Ted Koppel.
So they were burning an American flag. And so we sort of get into it. I try to take the flag away. They wouldn't let me take the flag away. And punches were thrown. And ironically, I was the one that was dragged off in cuffs. A few of them were as well. It only lasted, maybe 5 minutes. But we all agreed to stop, to drop charges, and we went on our way. But it did get some attention. But I think it was just
emotion.
Yeah, that's all.
Let's talk current events for a second. You know, you're in a primary, which is not that far away. What is it, April 30th? Is April 30th the primary
day? April 30th, that's correct.
Ed Markey, I think it's fair to say, is sort of the quintessential candidate for a liberal-leaning Democratic primary, which is what it is. On a whole host of issues, I assume you'd agree, he's to the left of you. He's got four times as much dough in the bank.
He does.
So how does a guy who at least is described as pro-life voted against Obamacare? That's you, by the way.
Yeah.
How do you win a Democratic primary in one of the most liberal states in America?
You know, one vote at a time. Just
time short.
Look, I think that I would bring a much different perspective to the United States Senate, and I think a lot of people agree with me.
What's that perspective?
Well, you know, I strapped on a pair of work boots for 18 years as an iron worker. I know what it's like to work paycheck to paycheck. I know what it's like to have your job go away because of a bad trade agreement. I used to work at the Framingham General Motors facility until GM closed down three of their U.S. plants and moved three plants over the border into Mexico. I know what it's like to stand in an unemployment line. And that's what a lot of people in Massachusetts and across the country are feeling right now. I know exactly how that feels when, you know, the bills are piling up. You don't know where your next job's coming from. Your family's relying on you. And I don't think there are many people in the United States Senate that know what that feels like. And I think it was reflected about a year ago when we had a debate over whether we're going to extend unemployment benefits to workers in this country at a time when unemployment was as high as it's ever been since the Great Depression. And we had a Massachusetts U.S. senator who voted against the extension of unemployment benefits. So, you know, I think...
But the guy you're running against didn't vote against the extension of unemployment.
No,
you're
no,
not
no,
running
no,
against
but,
Scott
no,
Brown.
But if you want to talk about that, we can talk about that. I mean, look, I have in my current U.S. congressional district, I have about 727,000 people. I have probably 20% of my population in my district doesn't even have a bank account. And yet we gave $787 billion to Wall Street. We didn't ask for any accountability. We let them stuff the banks full of that money. We let them pay their own, workers bonuses for putting us in the toilet, you know, financially. I voted against that three times. Mr. Markey, my opponent, voted for that three times. So, I mean, there are some definite contrasts in terms of what we stand for, what we believe in. There are a lot of things we agree on, no question about it.
By the way, our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to talk to Congressman Lynch.
Congressman Lynch, you mentioned before, you have been called pro-life over and over again, but I've looked at your record. You displease both the pro-life and the pro-choice sides.
I do.
Yeah, so what are you?
You're
kind of in the middle.
Well, you know, I refer to myself as pro-life, but I have read, you know, a lot of press lately that, you know, some of the church leaders have said I'm not really pro-life. Some of the activists on the pro-life side have said I'm not pro-life enough. But
you'd not get rid of Roe v. Wade, which is the Supreme Court's decision legalizing abortion.
Right. Right. That would be crazy. But look, I'm not an expert on church teachings, but I am an expert on what I believe. And I don't believe that getting rid of Roe v. Wade, attacking that, is part of any solution. Look, you're not going to end abortion. You're just going to change the setting of those abortions from a clinical setting to one that is much more dangerous for women. And I also believe, you know, to the chagrin of some of the folks on that side, that the use of contraceptives and access to contraceptives. If we look at what we've done recently, we've got the highest level of access for women counseling. Planned Parenthood is a big part of that. I actually stood on the floor of the United States House to oppose the Republican efforts to zero out funding for Planned Parenthood because they are the ones that are stopping an increase in the level of, the number of unwanted pregnancies. They are the one that are doing the meaningful work, and we've actually, in the last couple of years, seen the results. The statistics show that greater access to contraceptives and birth control counseling has led to a lower number of abortions. So, you know, my question on the floor of the House to them was, what are you trying to do here?
Yeah, but Steve Lynch, that's your question. Here's my question. So you're for federal money for Planned Parenthood. You don't want to repeal Roe v. Wade. You're for embryonic stem cell research. Other than your personal view, where you're against abortion, as was Mario Cuomo, Jesse Jackson, and Ted Kennedy, how are you even marginally pro? What's the pro-life part of you that has such a lure
partial
to the pro-life organizations?
Partial birth abortion. And that's not a position that is informed by my faith. It's informed by science. You know, the American Medical Association said this is not something that we want to do. There are cases that those late-term abortions are necessary, like rape, incest, where the health of the mother is endangered. And certainly I voted for that amendment that would allow that in those cases. But I think that, you know, we have a different situation. And that position and that construct of law is not contrary to Roe v. Wade. That's enabled by Roe v. Wade.
You are listening to Congressman Stephen Lynch. You are also listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to join us. You know, Congressman, you talked before about strapping on the work boots. We know you're an iron worker. You grew up in the old Colony Project. You got a great story. You donated part of your liver. I think it was your brother-in-law that you gave it to and stuff like that. But when
it was a used liver, though.
A used liver.
It was used. I'm Irish. I didn't even know they let the Irish donate their livers.
Well, it was good enough, Congressman.
Yeah, yeah. It's still working, too. He's doing all right.
Good.
I fight him for a parking spot every night. He lives right behind my house.
But the reason I mention that is when Ed Markey announced that he was running for office, we heard about how his father drove a milk truck and Markey himself drove an ice cream truck to put himself through Boston College. I think somebody was staying up all night long at some supermarket or something like that. It's like the regular guy sweepstakes. You know, before Scott Brown ran out, it was going to be a battle of the barn jackets. You had the $40 barn jacket. Scott Brown had the $600 barn jacket. What's this about? It's like you have to be...
Well, I think those guys are stretching. I think Mr. Markey and Mr. Brown was stretching. Look, you know, Scott Brown, he did have the barn jacket that he got at Saks Fifth Avenue. he did drive his pickup truck from his law office to work, to his house, you know. He never went close to a construction site. All I was saying in that context was, look, I'm the real deal. I had a welding machine. The bed of my pickup was rotting out. I drove to a construction site for work for many, many years. Ed Markey said, you know, he drove an ice cream truck during summers for his college education. I understand that. That is not the same as making a living for 18 years, you know, as an iron worker strapping on a pair of work boots. There's just no comparison.
What Marjorie's trying to say, Steve Lynch, she always says to me, I want to find the one Democrat who didn't grow up in a three-decker in Dorchester whose mother was not a washerwoman. In any case, Mary
Your
from Cambridge.
Was not a washerwoman.
Mary from Cambridge has been waiting for a long time to talk to the Senate candidate, Congressman Stephen Lynch. Good morning, Mary, and welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hello, Mary.
Thank you very much. I wonder if Congressman Lynch were already in the Senate, would he vote to confirm Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense? And would he send F-16s and tanks to the Egyptian government?
Great questions. How about it, Steve Lynch?
Yeah, well, no on the latter question. I think that as much as we had hoped that the Arab Spring would bring democracy to that region, and I was there. I was in Egypt on the election day when Morsi actually won. Our highest hopes have not been realized. And I think we have to be very, very careful, about that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and the influence they have on the Egyptian government and the future of Egypt. So I would have great caution about what we do next, Mary.
How about Hagel?
On the Chuck Hagel thing, you know, I'd like to dive into his. I probably know as much as about Chuck Hagel as you do. I would need much more information on deciding whether I would vote to confirm him. I know he has said some absurd things about AIPAC, you know, and he has said
the largest pro-Israel lobbying organization
right,
in America.
Right. And there were unfortunate comments.
So you're saying you can imagine a situation where you would vote not to confirm Chuck Hagel if you're elected to the Senate and he wasn't in place already?
Well, I don't know. I don't know enough about it. You're asking me to make a decision when I don't have enough information. What I read in the papers is what I've read about Chuck Hagel. I haven't really been focusing on his confirmation.
I heard a couple more things about him. One, that he's on the board of directors of a bank that's being investigated for helping Iran to circumvent the sanctions.
I did not know that.
And I also heard that he had a very bad record on gay rights. And I also heard that he agreed that America was the world's bully. So,
by the way, on the gay rights thing, for whatever it's worth, he's apologized pretty profusely.
And it was a while ago. I cut him a little slack on that. I think it was 1998
Thanks, Mary, for the call,
or 1999.
Though.
Yeah. The one thing I do want to interject here is that Mr. President Obama is trying to put a team together, and so I give him a little bit of leeway. I give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt that he knows. Look, I support the president, and if the president wants an individual, I will at least give him the benefit of the doubt coming out of the box. Now, we would have to drill down on Hegel's issues. The Iran banking issue would I co-chair the task force on terrorism financing and nonproliferation on the House side. So that's an issue I'm keenly involved in. That would matter. That would matter to me.
One last question for me, Congressman. Everybody knows Citizens United was a Supreme Court decision which basically allowed unlimited amounts of money to flow into political campaigns. Mm. And the Dred Scott decision was another Supreme Court decision back in 1857, yeah, which was pro-slavery. Your opponent, Ed Markey, kind of lumped them both together as two bad decisions. You thought that was what?
That was a poor analogy. I really did. I think Ed just tried to make a comparison. He was making a speech. It was a loose analogy. I don't think he really thought about it. Look, Dred Scott was an atrocious, yep, you know, human rights tragedy that you know kept African Americans in bondage.
Was this a small potatoes kind of thing on Markey's part, or a big deal thing?
I don't know. I'll let the listeners decide that. But I know what I think. Look, Citizens United is a terrible decision, and I think it really changes the nature of representative democracy in our country, and we have to get rid of it. And I would support a constitutional amendment to get rid of that. I really, really would. I think it's you're allowing in Citizens United, you're allowing corporations and the machinery of profit making to hook up a fire hose to our political financing system, so that you know a company like ExxonMobil can just shovel money behind a candidate. And that gives what does that do?
So
to
can
the,
unions too, the world from which
no,
you come.
No. There's a distinct difference.
What is that?
Well, the unions pass the hat. They ask requests. They have to get permission. You pass the hat. Look, I'm a former union president. You pass the hat among iron workers who might on average make $40,000 a year. Mm-hmm. You pass the hat among those and ask them for. That's quite different than Exxon using or Apple or Microsoft or Goldman Sachs using their competitive financial advantage in the world to funnel that level of cash into a political campaign. Much, much different. You know, the Supreme Court did us a huge disservice by saying, oh, we're going to treat ExxonMobil and Goldman Sachs the same as we treat the nurses union. And it's all fair and good. There is a totally different fundraising capacity between those two groups.
Representative Lynch, thank you so much for being with us. And good luck to you and your wife finding parking spaces over on G Street,
yeah,
the rest of the snowy winter in South Boston.
And you've already said you're happy to debate Ed Markey in this studio.
I am.
The end of Signature Collection.
I said that previously. Yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
Good to see you, Steve Lynch.
Okay, this is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Everybody's talking about sequestration. Does anybody have any idea what it means? Plus, they're also buzzing about a certain Republican trashing Scott Brown. Joining us to talk about and detail these stories, Peter Cassis, executive editor of the Boston Phoenix, and the Brown trashing Republican analyst, Todd Donkey.
Everybody's talking about sequestration, as Marjorie said, but does anybody know what it means? And does anybody really care? You listen to Boston Public Radio. Joining us are two guys. One is best known to you, as Marjorie said, for being the top guy at the Phoenix. The other for being a crack, and I mean crack GOP consultant. But to Marjorie and me, Todd Domke is best known as the Republican who did trash Scott Brown on Fox News before he even appeared. It was quite bold. And, of course, Peter Kadzis was Marjorie's former tenant on her third floor. Peter and Todd,
right.
Thank you. He raised his fist. Good to see you both, gentlemen.
Peter, those were the golden years, were they not?
Back when I was thin.
That's right. We were young and irresponsible. So, Todd Zopke, before we get any further, you did do something rather astonishing for a Republican. I called you for column in the Herald about Scott Brown's maiden appearance on Fox News with Sean Hannity. And you said to me, quote, "I wonder what political analysis Scott's done in the past. It is noteworthy. Has he ever said anything that has great political insight?" Wow. One Republican trashing another one.
No, I was
defend yourself there,
I was just afraid that losing had gone to his head.
Losing had gone to his head.
And, you know, going on to Fox News as an analyst when I don't remember him ever saying anything that insightful in the way of political analysis. Have you? Can you? Someone tell me.
Well, Marjorie's actually asking you the question.
I know. I've had time to think about it. I still haven't come up with anything. So, I mean, he's best known for being, evasive, waiting to see how these big debates play out before he decides how to vote, and sort of talking about being moderate and bipartisan and mushy. And now all of a sudden he's on Fox News, and yet he then says, well, he might also run for governor. Now, come on. You can't take the money and run in this case. You can't be the Fox News guy and then come back and say, oh, yes, I'm the bipartisan independent guy.
Well, you know, especially since I understand that Geraldo at large has been circling around the former senator for a regular role. Do you realize that?
Wow.
Hey, speaking of the seat that he didn't run for, you're Kadzis, not Galzinis. I knew that. I had a problem.
That's okay.
Peter Kadzis, speaking of the seat that Scott Brown chose not to run, but let's start on the Democratic side. Steve Lynch was just here.
Yeah.
Ed Markey, obviously the other candidate, long-term Democratic incumbent. On paper, you got to say it's Markey's race. Again, he starts with four times as much money in the bank, more than $3,800,000. More, as I said, of a sort of the traditional liberal to the more working class, more centrist Steve Lynch. Can Steve Lynch win this thing?
I think he's got an uphill battle. I mean, I like Lynch. I mean, I think he's much smarter than most people would give him credit for. I mean, the fact is that most voters in the state know neither Markey nor Lynch. The only reason I'd give it to Markey at the moment is just because of money. I mean, Lynch in some ways has a Scott Brown-like problem of how does he get his name in front of as many people. The difference is there's, you know, no particular negatives attached to Markey the way they were attached to the Attorney General. So,
Attorney General isn't Martha Coakley.
Yes,
it's
in Martha Coakley.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey,
well, but the thing about Markey that I think is problematic is he's been there, 36 years?
36
at Markey.
Years.
And does something spring to your mind? I know that he was responsible for getting that shots of the gushing oil coming out.
I can think of a couple of the first of all, he's a leader on the environment. I mean, now some people might say he leads too vigorously. In terms of internet policy, I mean, something that should matter a lot to the state, he's been out there. So, no, I think, you know, Markey has a good bit of legislation that he's played with. But I don't see that as, you know, that's a nice thing for us here to talk about. But most voters in the state don't know who either of them are.
Right.
Yeah, speaking of not knowing who either, I have to say, by the way, Ed Markey is already scheduling interviews for early March. Let's talk about the Republicans, though. There is Gabriel Gomez, the former Navy SEAL, who no one ever heard of until a couple of weeks ago. He's talking to nobody. Dan Winslow, former judge, former state rep, used to give interviews all the time. He's now talking to nobody. Sullivan, the former U.S. attorney, also collecting signatures, talking to nobody. The primary is in 2 months. I've never seen a campaign where everybody on one side of the aisle is not talking to the press. What is that about?
Well, I think it's partly a carryover from the Romney and Brown model of being paranoid about the media. And of their handlers keeping them under wraps and worrying that they might go off script. And we saw the price Charlie Baker paid for that.
He'll be with us tomorrow at 1 o'clock,
one
by
of
the
his
way.
Managers,
so be careful what you say.
Well, one of his managers is Gomez's manager or spokesman or whatever. And so it's the same thing. I said during the time, though, that Charlie Baker was making this mistake of his campaign seeming too corporate And that's what the Republican operatives tend to do. They keep it all about systems and planning as opposed to persuasion and welcoming controversy, because that's what a Republican needs to have controversy, needs the free media, and then needs to win that debate. But instead, they become so fearful that they don't speak with conviction.
And well, they don't speak at all. I mean, Gabriel Gomez, right. What I thought is this beautiful, brilliant video that was released the other day about being out in the world, collecting signatures, doing absolutely no interviews. How do you win a primary in 2 months?
Well, you also...
What, do you just buy your way to April 30th? What do you do?
No, but if none of the candidates are speaking to the media, then one of the three will have to win. But no, they will have to speak. And to some extent, you have candidates who really aren't up to snuff on the senatorial issues or even, you know, state local issues. I know it's pathetic, but this is the problem we have. The Democrats have two long-time congressmen.
When are they going to be able to speak to their second term?
But it's not just that. It's a human nature sort of thing. I mean, reporters are human beings, too. If people are gracious to you and they talk to you and they answer your phone calls and respond to you and you get to like them... you tend to give them much better coverage than someone that you've never...
I agree. And I have been an advocate for Republicans being more creative, being more open, welcoming the debate, talking to the media. The only way you do get better at interviews is by doing it.
Well, especially in a short campaign.
Couldn't there be a simple answer to this? And I'm not being sarcastic. Maybe they have nothing to say.
Well, they're not. How are they going to, if they have nothing to say on February 25th, how are they going to have something to say by April 3rd? I mean, in all seriousness, Peter, if you have a three-candidate Republican race, it would seem to me you would never pass up an opportunity for free media, would you?
Listen, I'm with you, but here in the state where, you know, people have IQs that exceed the double digits, it's very hard to say something that's nominally Republican and, you know, not sound stupid.
But look.
I mean, Charlie Baker is governor. It's annoying as it must have been when people asked him about Darwin. You know, just couldn't quite summon it up to say, of course I think Darwin was right, but let's talk about a serious issue that matters to Massachusetts.
I mean, that was a problem that Charlie Baker sounded like a CFO and all that. But look, let's get real about this, though, too. You can make blunders in interviews that cost you in a big way. We just heard you do an interview with Steve Lynch, who again spent way too much time, partly because of your questions, talking about abortion. That's not helpful to him. Whereas Markey, with a few phone calls during the same time, could get enough money to buy saturation radio and all the channels for weeks. So sometimes
I disagree. I think it is helpful to him because I think a pro-life stand, if he were just pro-life, would hurt him a lot. He's not, in my estimation, pro-life. He's in the mushy middle, which is where a lot of voters are. And I think he needs to get that out in Massachusetts very strongly.
But if you have to speak several minutes about an issue... That is not going to be a winning issue because when you're talking about TV news coverage or regular radio news coverage or newspaper stories, you get a soundbite. If you can't explain an issue in one sentence, you're in trouble.
Well, let's move on to Peter Kazis from the Boston Phoenix. Does anybody care about sequestration? We've been hearing it nonstop in the news. Know what it is. Understand what's going to happen. I mean, are we on the edges of our seats over
this? Can I tell you one
not?
Person who cares before Peter answers? Deval Patrick cares. Deval Patrick was on Meet the Press yesterday. What the governor had to say. He was on with Governor Jindal from Louisiana. Here's Deval Patrick.
First of all, this isn't about whether there are or are not going to be cuts. The president's plan has cuts. In fact, to some extent, deeper cuts than the sequester provides. It also has the closing of loopholes, some of the same loopholes that Speaker Boehner favored only a little while ago. And what we've seen is more of the same. The congressional Republicans move the goalposts as soon as the president comes their way. He's got a plan on the table that has an awful lot of things they say they support. Put it to a vote, because with Democrats and moderate Republicans, it will pass and it will be good for the economy.
Okay, that was Deval Patrick yesterday on Meet the Press. We are here with Peter Kazis from the
Boston
Phoenix.
I'll tell you who cares in Massachusetts, and this is the effect in Massachusetts isn't necessarily going to be what people think it is. For example, the biomedical research community is going to be hit very hard, much harder than, say, poor people in Massachusetts, maybe. Now, no one's going to feel particularly badly for Harvard researchers or researchers at Tufts. But, you know, Harvard University, for example, 60% of all their research money comes from federal funds. That's 16% of Harvard's overall budget. You say, well, who cares about Harvard? Harvard is one of the,
huge
if
employer.
Not the largest largest employer in the state. So it's going to play out a little differently here than it'll play out in South Dakota, which is the state that's going to be most affected by it. But listen, this whole sequester talk is a little bit of a red herring. The real date to worry about is March 27th. On or around then, that's when the funding for the rest of the fiscal year has to come up. I mean, this this sequester budget stuff is something that's going to trickle down through the economy. March 27th is the really key date. That's, you know, that's when the money for the rest of the year is going to be appropriated.
When is it going to take us 5 hours to get on an airplane in Logan? That's what I want to know.
They're saying the guy, the Secretary of Transportation, was saying it's going to happen virtually right away for safety reasons. See, my sense is that Deval Patrick, I thought, was quite eloquent yesterday. I don't think anybody in Massachusetts, except the people directly involved, are even thinking about this thing. Barack Obama has tried to lay the blame on your party, Todd Domke, saying they prefer cuts and all these things to asking their wealthy contributors to give a few dollars more, close a loophole. But I don't get the sense that any real people, they're so fed up with this Congress that I don't think anybody even cares about this at this stage. Do they or do they?
Well, I think both parties have cried wolf so many times that people, you know, aren't as alarmed. You know, the rhetoric keeps escalating. You know, instead of crying wolf, they cry Godzilla or whatever. You know, now this is a sequestration. Is that a scary enough word? Is it close enough to castration?
I found fiscal cliff to be even scarier.
I know. Well, maybe we should call this a cluster cliff. You know, really
careful there. Thank you. Appreciate
cluster
that.
Something else.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, but a lot of people, does the word make them think, oh, yes, the fiscal situation with the federal government? Or does it make them think, you know, I really have to broaden my vocabulary?
Yeah.
What does sequestration mean? And none of my friends have talked to me about it. But so I think, but it's curious to me, though, that the federal government, in scaring us with all these different cuts, that somehow, and there are many lists of what will be awful, that they can't, that they don't mention, okay, we're going to have to cut some consultants, we're going to have to cut some, you know, duplicative costs here. No, none of that cost. It's all these other
things. You know,
things.
That's short money. That's symbolically important. But, you know, all that stuff about PR flacks and that kind of stuff.
I know, but none of it can be cut except things that would hurt us. And God forbid if Harvard should have to dip into its $1 trillion endowment, you know, because the federal government doesn't.
It's not quite a trillion, but we got it.
Yeah.
Republican analyst Todd Domke and Peter Kazis from the Boston Phoenix. I want to ask you guys both a political question about our Governor Deval Patrick. I know he said he's going to go back into the private sector and make some money. But do you believe for a second that he's not – that isn't just a temporary – he's on like a charm offensive everywhere, and he's gotten so much more charming as his term goes on. Isn't he going to come back 2 years, 3 years, 4 years to do some national run? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I could see him taking the point of position. But listen, 2 years ago, in talking to people who were reasonably close to him or knew him in other walks of life, said, look, this has been something he always wanted to do, but he wants to go out there and make some more money. This was before he – you know, declared that he was taking himself out of the running. I believe the guy. Now, it would be tough if his buddy Barack Obama or someone else, you know, tapped him on the shoulder and said, would you be attorney general? Or would you be? That's a call from your nation, and for anyone, that would be a difficult thing to return. I take him at his word. I think he's going to go out there and make some more dough.
What if it turns out that he got a different tap on his shoulder, Todd Domke? The tap was, Lieutenant Governor's on the phone, and he's in a little bit of trouble. Should Tim Murray be sweating? We all know Michael McLaughlin, who is this total slime ball. I don't know if I should say that Oh, he actually pled guilty the other day, so it's okay.
He is.
Former head
right.
of the Chelsea Housing Authority lied about his inflated salary. He's taking money that should be going to poor tenants and basically using it for his own benefit. The conventional wisdom, Todd Domke, is he's going to get a light sentence in return for him basically flipping on Tim Murray in terms of some fundraising violations, that sort of thing. Why are you looking at me so strangely?
Well, that's just my curious look. No, that's just my look. That's my curious
Tim
look.
Murray
like,
in trouble. By the way, Deval Patrick.
Like, is there a question coming?
Yeah,
that's why I look at
it's
you
pretty,
that way.
Deval Patrick has been incredibly loyal to this guy. And it seems to me if your lieutenant governor goes down, goes down for criminal reasons, then the question Marjorie asked Peter is moot
let's put it this way. Just thinking about McLaughlin, I think, will make Tim Murray want to spend more time with his family.
Well, also, if people have forgotten, there was the beginning of problems for Tim Murray, I think, when he was going 108 miles per hour and nearly killed himself in a car accident
there
when he claimed
that.
He was in his pajamas and his slippers and he claimed he was going out.
I wish the Boston Herald had covered that story.
Yes, yeah. We covered it. We covered it wall to wall because he was going out allegedly to look for a Boston Herald.
It
took him 30 miles to find one. We thought that was a little odd.
Because the lieutenant governor is such a zilch job, whatever corruption is or isn't visited upon him will have no effect. And also, Duvall has become Reagan-esque with this coat of Teflon he has. Here's the guy who, for the first 2 years, you know, got slapped around and beaten up all the time. He has this zen sense about him. He just floats above
it.
I don't think
when he's asking for a $2 billion tax increase, if they're for things like transportation infrastructure,
education. He was in our office recently. We were going over the budget almost line by line. I was impressed by his command. I mean, I studied up for a long time. He knew just about where everything was.
Right.
But he said, well, listen, if we can't do it this way, here's another way we can do it. And here's another.
He's not desperate. No, he's not. I think Duvall, by the way, does plan to make a lot of money quickly, and he can. He's in a position to make a lot of money.
He's going to Fox News
then,
too, with Scott Brown, or what?
I think, in his mind, President.
Absolutely. President. I am absolutely with you. I think he has to wait a while.
He's a young guy. He's young 50s.
He's a very young guy. And also, if you hear, as I had the opportunity to, both Barack Obama and Deval Patrick speak. Obama came to Boston to speak for Deval when he was running for re-election. Deval Patrick is a better speaker.
Yeah.
He is fantastic.
He has improved, and
his cadence, he can go from being, you know, very slow and very somber to, like,
right.
you know,
and
run
I,
down
and
the
I,
house.
And I think he sees, like, with Joe Biden shooting himself in the foot with a shotgun, and then Hillary Clinton, you know, she could be boring and old and everything in a position where
I think she doesn't
want to run. She is going to be 69 or whatever.
I don't think she wants to run.
He could be in a position where he makes it happen and winning the Democratic nomination, as preposterous as that may seem.
Hey, can we come back to the city just for a second? We're talking to Peter Galzinas. Peter Kadzis from the Boston Phoenix. We like Peter Galzinas from the Herald, too. And you're who? You're Todd Domke, the former Republican consultant.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Whoever you are. Okay, fine. Let's come to a local election. Tom Menino, he hasn't said whether he's running again. He's obviously back
on
his feet. He's doing well. He's running. Here is one man who has the courage to go where other men fear to tread, City Councilor John Connolly the other day.
Listen, I think Tom Menino is a great guy, and I know his heart is committed to the city, but I don't think we can change our schools if we don't get new leadership and new energy.
See, my sense is, Peter, when you say... you're Kadzis, right?
When
you say, I think he's a great guy, and I think he really loves the city, it sort of indicates already you're a little nervous about running against the guy who, if you lose, a la Sam Yun, you have to move out of town. I mean, is this a really serious challenge to this guy?
Oh, yeah, this is going to be a serious challenge.
Why do you say that?
Because Connolly has no place left to go. You can only be on the city council for so long. And I think he's smart enough to do an up and out. Look, if by some miracle Menino does not run, Connolly will be in the race. But
and so will 30 other people, by the way.
So is an impressive guy.
He'll be in there first. I think Connolly is a very impressive guy. He's thought very deeply about the schools. And what I find interesting about him is he's been able to make a series of other connections. I think his biggest problem is going to be that the media has given Tom Menino pretty much of a walk, you know, during his time in office. And that I think Connolly's going to have trouble getting traction on issues other than the school because the media has bought into Menino. Menino is the most successful politician the city of Boston has
seen. You know
what
the most amazing statistic ever? When he ran for re-election for whatever time was last time, the Globe did a poll, 57% of the people in Boston, 57% said they had met him personally, not heard him give a talk, but had met him personally. That is really hard to overcome, no matter where you are.
Listen, with the Pope retiring, we're now down to one only one elective lifetime office.
Yeah, the mayor was.
The mayor of Boston. And, you know, and these other these city councils have been acting like the Cardinals. You know, they figure, you know, they're in a quandary. They don't want to make the mistake of trying to become infallible. Mm-hmm. You know, so they all act as if they're not really eager. Connolly has now done it. And I think he's done it on the right issue, too, by the way.
Schools.
Absolutely.
And he's got kids in the schools,
absolutely.
Too.
And if Menino could be introspective enough to think about what's best for the city, I think he'd realize that, you know, the city does need energetic leadership. We're supposed to be the Athens of America, but where's the democracy?
Hey, Tom, before you go, I just want to give you one more opportunity. You started this segment, you were bad-mouthing Scott Brown.
Yes, he was.
Then you bad-mouthed Charlie Baker, who is likely... Is there another Republican you want to... You're a Republican consultant. Any other Republican you want to bad-mouth before you go?
I've been equal. I've balanced. I think I bashed a few Democrats. I was saying, should I get to Markey, too?
No, it's out of time. We'll do that next time.
Okay, we've been talking with Peter Kazis, executive editor of the Boston in Phoenix and political analyst who says he's a Republican anyway. That's Todd Donkey. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here. When we come back, we're going to look at climate change, rather, a huge priority for President Barack Obama, not so much for the American public. A recent Pew survey says only 34% of Americans want the White House and Congress to take this on. We're going to be joined by someone who'll tell us why most of us are wrong. This is Boston Public Radio on 89.7 WGBH.